It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. One of the earliest mentions of right livelihood and work practice in Zen literature is a famous story involving a Chinese master, Pai Chang. Dogen relates the story of Pai Chang in the Shobo Genzo fascicle of Gyoji, which means ceaseless practice. So this is Dogen's relating the story of Pai Chang. There was not a single day in the life of Pai Chang from time to time, from the time he became attendant of Mai Tzu until the evening of his death, when he did not labor to serve people and serve his assembly. To our gratitude, he left the words, "A day of no samu," which means work, "a day of no samu is a day of not eating." Pai Chang was at an extreme of old age, and on occasions of, quote, "all invited samu," when everybody labored vigorously, the whole assembly felt pain and regret that their teacher should be included in the work party. At last, at one samu time, some monks hid his tools and would not hand them over. That day, Pai Chang did not eat as compensation for not using mattock and bamboo basket. He said, "A day of no samu is a day of not eating." As Dogen observed, these words fill us even today with profound gratitude because they directly address the relationship between work and service, between dignity and usefulness, and between caring for others and being cared for by others. In terms of right livelihood, these are the values to which Buddhists adhere and try to practice in daily life. J.C. Kumarappa, an Indian philosopher and economist, once wrote, "If the nature of work is properly appreciated and applied, it will stand in the same relation to the higher faculties as food is to the physical body. It nourishes and enlivens the higher person and urges him to produce the best he is capable of." And I wonder, do our current choices of livelihood fulfill this description of feeling nourished and enlivened in the way that Pai Chang, for example, obviously did with his mattock and basket? As Buddhist practitioners, our deepest intention is to benefit other beings while causing no harm. While we diligently apply this intention to our daily work in combination with our practice of the Eightfold Path and the Buddhist precepts, our work becomes spiritual practice and right livelihood simply appears naturally. So by living this life with the intention to benefit beings while causing no harm, and by holding the precepts in our consciousness as we behave, and on the Eightfold Path, that's living the spiritual life. I mean, that in itself is living the spiritual life and right livelihood then. Whatever you do with that consciousness will be right livelihood. Here's a poem called Reading the Record of Ehei. Ehei is Ehei Dogen by Ryokan. There'll be some terms in here that you won't understand. They're kind of insider references to passages in Dogen, but don't just hold them lightly. Don't let them bother you. So here's the poem. In the vacant darkness of a spring midnight, sleet was falling on the bamboo in the garden. I wanted to ease my loneliness, but found nothing helpful. Reaching back, I searched for the record of Ehei. Beneath the clear window, on top of the desk, I burned incense, lit an oil lamp, opened and silently read the book. Dropping off body and mind is simply genuine reality. Dogen plays with the dragon's jewel in 10,000 ways. His exceptional ability caught the tiger's cub. His mature and imposing style was like that of the ancestors in India. I remember that a long time ago, while staying at Ansuji Monastery, my late teacher upheld the true Dharma eye. At that time, I experienced the pivotal point for transforming myself. Therefore, I asked him to let me read the texts, and I intimately practiced following Dogen's teachings. Further, I realized that I had been wastefully using my strength. After that, I left my teacher and traveled far and wide to practice with other teachers. What is my affinity with Ehei Dogen? Wherever I went, I respectfully practiced the teachings of the true Dharma eye. More years than I can remember have passed away. I forgot the function, returned to my home country, and have been living the idle, lazy life. Now I hold this record and am able to visit it. Dogen's teaching is beyond compare with any other, yet no one investigates whether it is a jewel or stone. His writings have been covered with dust for 500 years because people do not have an eye for penetrating the Dharma. Everyone has been the same. Who could uphold Dogen's teachings for others? I yearn for Dogen's ancient way. Thinking of present day people, I feel pain deep in my heart. Throughout the night, by the light of the lamp, my tears have not ceased, completely soaking the record of the ancient Buddha Ehei. Next day, an old man from the neighborhood visits my grass hut and asks me why the book is wet. Although I try to say something, struggling in my mind, I cannot explain to him. Despite my efforts, I cannot explain. I lower my head and pause, then say only one thing. Last night, the rain came in and drenched my book container. Shohaku Okamura Roshi comments, in the early spring night, that means early spring because the night was midnight. In the early spring night, it is still cold and a mixture of rain and snow is falling on the bamboo in the garden. Ryokan feels deep loneliness, but he has nothing with which to console himself. He reaches back and finds the text of the record of Ehei. He burns incense, lights a lamp, and begins to read quietly. It's clear, I think it's clear that Ryokan is lonely, but also profoundly lonely because he longs for the Dharma. Today, he says, No one cares. Dogen's writings are covered with dust because people do not have an eye for penetrating the Dharma. Who can uphold Dogen's teachings for others? There's nobody. I yearn for Dogen's ancient way. He says, thinking of present day people, I feel pain deep in my heart. So he's weeping for the state of the world, empty of Dharma, empty of ones wishing to learn, empty of ones able to teach, for this ryokan is bereft. I can't help but think how timely this is, considering the state of our own world right this minute. But anyway, Okamura Roshi continues, by studying Shobo Genzo, by the way, Shobo Genzo, in case you don't know, is the entire writings of Dogen. There are 95 fascicles, basically. Some disagree with that, but 95 fascicles. And he wrote them really over not maybe 5 to 7 or so years during his life when he was doing this. And that's why we refer to which fascicle it is. So by studying the Shobo Genzo, just to let you know what that is, Ryokan says that he experienced the pivotal point for transforming himself. That sort of means he attained enlightenment, but we don't just say, you know, I attained enlightenment. It's kind of ridiculous. Until then, he probably, and so this is the critical point of today's talk, actually, what I'm about to say. Until then, he probably thought, quote, Ryokan studied and practiced the Dharma using his own power and effort to see the true reality of all beings. But now he finds that all beings come to him and allow him to practice. This is one of the most important points of Dogen's teaching. So when Ryokan says that he experienced the pivotal point for transforming himself, he means that he went from thinking, I, Ryokan, studied and practiced the Dharma, you know, using my own power and effort. Instead, he saw that the true reality was that all beings come to me and allow me to practice. All beings come to me and allow me to practice. It's not I do this, but all beings come to me and allow this to happen. This is very important. And actually, if you think about it, if we lack an inherent individual self, how can it be otherwise? Everything is interconnected. So of course, all beings will come to me and allow me to practice, of course. I recall telling you a story of a very senior student, Blanche Hartmann, who was once in the Zendo practicing Zazen, when Suzuki Roshi asked, what are you doing? And she said, I'm doing Zazen. And he screamed at her, don't you ever say that you are doing Zazen. Zazen does Zazen. So it makes the same point and the true point that the whole world comes to us and supports us to do what is most important and most truly ourselves. But if we don't listen or override what we hear, we may not realize what or who that is. And I see this so often. You know, the universe is telling you and you're not paying attention. And this happened to me for most of my life. And so our real job, our life job, is to become awake to who we really are. right livelihood starts with who am I? From there, it is cyclical. Our authentic voice voices itself out into the world, which reflects it back and supports it to continue voicing itself. And from there begins a co-creation between your authentic self, the, let's say authentic us and the world. There's a co-creation of what we never alone could have thought of. So Ryokan trained with his teacher, and when his teacher died, he traveled around and trained with other teachers. Eventually, he returned to his home village. By sitting for long hours in his grass hut and begging for food, which in itself is a spiritual practice called takuhatsu, and being out and about playing and teaching the village children, he naturally led a spiritual life. Because he was playing and teaching the village children, the parents could work without worrying about their children. All beings came to him and allowed him to practice. Do you see? He got trained from his teacher. He knew who he was. He came back to his village, and he says he just lazed around, but actually he sat many hours in his hut by himself, and he did takuhatsu as a way of getting food. And then he loved children, and he loved playing with them. And of course, as he was doing this, he was teaching them. And then the parents, of course, could definitely trust their children in his presence. And so everything like naturally evolved. So if you look carefully, there will be a sequence of events in your life that will be self-correcting, that is, letting you know if you're on the right track. And the sequence of events goes something like this. First, who am I? Who am I? And when you get that right, there'll be the second, some form of training. Some form of training. Ryokan trained with his teacher. Third, the universe hears authentic and trained you and rejoices with a mirror-like response. A mirror-like response. Things happen to help you and also sharpen the focus and perfect the direction that is now becoming a co-created project, you and the universe. Your life begins to feel correct, and it may feel also speeded up. And fourth, things keep happening and re-emerging such that authentic you becomes more and more authentic and increasingly verified by the world. Regarding the training, there's who am I, and you really need to get that. You need to get who am I. And you might just have to sit a long time and wait and realize what is the particular personal essence of your spirit. And when you get that right, some form of training has to happen. This training is usually between the who am I phase and the world mirroring back phase. And then comes the co-creating. Using monastic life as an example, Katagiri Roshi describes what happens in this training. This is what needs to happen. So this is Katagiri Roshi. And then when you are there, in, he means the monastery, your life is completely inside a bamboo stick. Usually your life is just like a snake, always going zigzag. But when you're right in the middle of a monastery, even though your life is a snake, the snake is in the bamboo stick. And very naturally, you straighten out. So your life can straighten out. Your life is straight, and that straight is really wonderful. Then, when you leave this bamboo stick, your life is really alive. This is what I learned in a monastery. I like it very much. That's why I want to have a Zen monastery. That is my dream. So that's what Katagiri Roshi said. And the life of Tomei, his wife, offers a great example of this whole discovery and co-creative process. Once when Yoshida Roshi, abbess of a temple in Japan, visited the San Francisco Zen Center, she was puzzled by why the students were not wearing roksus. This is a roksu. It has writing on the back. The ceremony of Jukai, where the student receives the precepts, includes the bestowal of a roksu. Katagiri suggested that the students learn to sew their own roksus, since the skill should be learned in America so that it can be continued to be practiced. And we did. I did sew my own roksu. Yoshida agreed to lead a sewing sesshin and lecture on the practice of sewing and wearing Buddha's robe. Then Katagiri asked Tomei, his wife, to begin studying with Yoshida Roshi immediately. Tomei's heart sank. From a child, she had felt no interest in sewing, and when the subject of learning sewing had come up before, she was secretly relieved when her first pregnancy intervened. So now, in 1970, when her husband sent her to Yoshida Roshi, she knew that this time she would not escape from sewing Buddha's robes. This is called a Buddha's robe. This is a miniature Buddha's robe for lay people. She quickly grabbed some cloth and headed off to learn how. Tomei remembers thinking, "I have bad karma because I have to learn to sew." But as soon as she started studying, Yoshida's words penetrated her heart. And Tomei realized, "I have good karma because I have met this teacher." 10 years after meeting Yoshida Roshi, Tomei Katagiri sewed her own 7-row okesa. That's the monk's robe, and zagu, which is a bowing cloth, but she sewed it as a lay practice. Usually okesas are for priests. She and her son traveled to Yoshida Roshi's temple in Japan, where Tomei received the okesa, zagu, and set of orioki bowls for eating in the zendo from her teacher in a ceremony that recognized her as a sewing master. Tomei recalls that she was able to accomplish her Nyohoe sewing in an extraordinarily short time of 1 week because her husband, Katagiri Roshi, took over domestic duties in support of her efforts. So she traveled to Japan to become basically a Zen master. And while her husband, you know, took care of, they had two kids, so one of the kids. The sewing, and I just want to explain, the sewing and wearing of the Kesa Buddha's robe as a spiritual practice is an ancient tradition going all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. In Japan, it is known as this Nyohoe, which means the Buddha's teaching represented as it really is by means of one's clothes or robe. That's what that title Nyohoe means. That's not important. I want to tell you one more thing about Tomei. She retired from teaching in 2013, naming three successors, one of whom is a traveling teacher who leads sewing retreats at various Zen centers. So despite herself, she became a Zen master and has three Dharma heirs. For Tomei, Katagiri Roshi's wife, sewing found her. You see this in the story. She had positioned herself for it to happen by marrying a Zen master to be. He wasn't a Zen master when she married him. But her "who am I" at first didn't include it. Then the world kind of grabbed her and all beings came to her and allowed her to practice. Studying with the Oshita Roshi was her bamboo stick. Then she herself became a bamboo stick for others to learn and pass on this precious practice. This idea of a bamboo stick is very important. It means a kind of training. A monastery is a kind of training. The military is a kind of training. A good university, medical school, mastery of a musical instrument, mastery of anything really, because it takes day after day effort for years. Finally, we are straightened out. From here, our life is very alive. When the San Francisco Zen Center celebrated its 25th anniversary in 1986, Katagiri Roshi, who had practiced with them and supported their effort through thick and thin for years before he founded his own Zen Center and monastery in Minnesota, he offered this poem for the 25th anniversary of San Francisco Zen Center. And it was published in the fall 1986 issue of the Windbell, Zen Center's former publication. And here was Katagiri's poem to Zen Center. The title of the poem is, "I Have Taught Nothing to You. You are nearly as old as the number of years it has been since I came to America. I have taught nothing to you at all. I have done nothing for you at all, but you have done a lot for me. I can tell you one thing you have taught me. Peel off your cultural skins one by one, one after another, again and again, and go on with your story. How thick are the layers of cultural clothes I have already put on? How would it be possible to tell a story without them? How would it be possible to peel off the thick wallpaper in my old house? How would it be possible to ease my pain whenever the paper is torn off? If I were not to agree with your teaching, believe it or not, my life would be drifting in space, like an astronaut separate from his ship, without any connections. Now I am aware that I am alone in the vast openness of the sea. No, excuse me, Now I am aware that I alone am in the vast openness of the sea and cause the sea to be the sea. Just swim, go on with your story. So here are some of the most important points from today's talk. This idea of, this is from Ryokan, that until then he probably thought Ryokan studied and practiced the Dharma using his own power and effort to see the true reality of all beings. But he now found that all beings came to him and allowed him to practice. This is one of the most important points of Dogen's teaching. And it's an incredibly important point. And we're so oriented that the other direction that we really have to drum it in, kind of. You just have to drum it in. The second important point is Paichang's words. A day of no samu is a day of not eating. And as Dogen observed, these words fill us even today with profound gratitude because they directly address the relationship between work and service, between dignity and usefulness, between caring for others and being cared for by others. The third important point is this bamboo stick idea. Usually your life is just like a snake, always going zigzag. But when you are right in the middle of a monastery or other serious training, even though your life is like a snake, that snake is in the bamboo stick, and very naturally you straighten out. Your life is straight, and that straight is really wonderful. Then, when you leave this bamboo stick, your life is really alive. Fourth, Tomei's thought, I have bad karma because I have to sew, but as soon as she started studying, Yoshida's words penetrated her heart, and Tomei realized, I have good karma because I have met this teacher. That's how things are. And fifth, our real job, our life job, is to become awake to who we really are. And you will not find your right livelihood until you know who you really are. There's no getting around it. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why so many people have what we call a midlife crisis. They didn't know who they really were. And then around 40, they realize who they are and they chuck everything. Okay, so here's some ideas for reflection during the week. First, that little passage in Katagiri Roshi's gift of a poem to Zen Center as it was celebrating its 25th anniversary, that phrase, now I'm aware that I alone am in the vast openness of the sea and cause the sea to be the sea. During your contemplation, hold these words of Katagiri Roshi in your mind. They're very powerful and profound words. I alone am in the vast openness of the sea and cause the sea to be the sea. Just hold those words. And the second idea for reflection during the week. Why do you think that after all those years of serving Suzuki Roshi and San Francisco Zen Center, Katagiri Roshi was there when I got there, and he was still there when I left, and I was there 11 years, and he was there longer too. Why do you think that after all those years of serving Suzuki Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center, Katagiri Roshi said, I have done nothing for you at all. I have taught nothing to you at all. That's a question for reflection. And also a third question for reflection is another passage in the same poem. How thick are the layers of cultural clothes I have already put on? How would it be possible to tell a story without them? How would it be possible to peel off the thick wallpaper of my old house? How would it be possible to ease my pain whenever the paper is torn off? So in what ways do these words pertain to yourself? That's the question for reflection. How does that relate to you? And then the fourth question, our idea for reflection, this part of the very last passage in Ryokan's poem. Next day, an old man from the neighborhood visits my grass hut and asks me why the book is wet. Although I try to say something, struggling in my mind, I cannot explain to him. Despite my efforts, I cannot explain. I lower my head and pause, then say only one thing. Last night, the rain came in and drenched my book container. What would Ryokan have said to his visitor had he been able? I mean, that is so miserably not actually what happened, even though it's literally what happened, sort of, at least out of his tears. But what would he have said if he could have said? That's the question for you. What would he have said? And then finally, how would you describe your own bamboo stick? How would you describe yourself both before it and after it? So your own training, it was a great image, I think, of how training feels and then the effect afterwards. It feels really terrible at first. It just feels way too tight and restrictive. But then you become straightened out. You're not looking, you're not zigzagging anymore. You're like straight on. I wonder if there are questions.
Thank you, Gail. So the first one that we just got right now is, I'm trying to understand that we won't know our right livelihood until we know ourselves. When to me find sewing without even thinking that was something she wanted to do? So I think it's a question like, when did Tome found sewing without even thinking that was something she wanted to do?
That's the whole world coming in to support us to be who we are. So she didn't land on it. But when the world... So finally, the world came in and so strongly presented it to her that she, And then she was able to do it beautifully with great feeling, master that practice. It's very complicated and intricate. This sewing, each stitch has to be done exactly perfectly, and you say a little blessing over each stitch. It's very time consuming and very detailed. But the point is that she had that in her from the very beginning. And it was brought out by the circumstances, just by the world's circumstances. But I had the same exact experience myself of, as a child, I thought I might want to be a writer, but then like a million things. And finally, after 11 years at Zen Center, I just said, I'm not getting out of bed until I know what I want to do, until I know who I am. And I finally had this teeny little thought of, I used to think I wanted to write. I'm going to try that. And then I left the Zen Center and started doing writing practice instead of Zazen as a way. And then it just, and then everything took off. Like the universe immediately jumped in and everything changed in my life. And that went on for 40 years. I think what you're asking is, how do we know if we don't know who we are, and then the universe presents something to us, how do we know that that's who we are? And I think if that's what you're asking, I think you know by the way it fits you. The way it, even if you didn't have the thought, the practice itself fits you. Even if you've never thought of it before, somehow the practice fits you, and then it fits you better and better. And then you realize, this is really fun. Yeah, I really am getting a lot out of this. And then you start discovering things, and that's when the universe starts co-creating with you. And then things happen that you never would have thought of. You just never would have thought of them. And it's because the universe is thinking of them for you. It's I have to say, it's magical. There's something magical about it. And if you have a linear mind and can't accept magical things. You may not ever buy this, but I've seen it happen to a lot of people, and it definitely happened for me, and I see that it happened for Tomé. I think it probably happens for a lot of Zen Roshis who, you know, probably maybe just stumbled into a Zendo one day and never ever dreamed they'd end up being a Zen Roshi. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next question that we have is, can you say more about this idea of training? I never thought about this before.
You know, Carl Jung once said that human beings are slugs. And if left to our, he didn't say the rest of, but if, like slugs, the rest of, if left to our own devices, we'd, you know, kind of drink beer and kick back and watch TV the rest of our lives. We all need a way of being upright. We need a way to get there. And it takes self-knowledge, a sense of purpose and direction, and some form of training and methodology in how to live. The method, the reason we need the training is that the method needs to be drummed into us because we're slugs. Because we're slugs, we need to be just like hammered home. And the monastery does this, but other things do it. Working for the post office could do it. Driving a truck could do it. Being a chef, because in all those things, there's an outside aspect to it that you have to subsume your own desires to accommodate. So immersion for the sake of something larger is a good part of it. And otherwise, our lives circle around our own desires. And if you really think about it, we lack an inherent individual self. And we stay in samsara because of our desires. So if we are centering our life, our individual life, which doesn't exist, around desires, which perpetuate samsara, we're on a jet plane route to suffering. There you have it. We're on a jet plane route to suffering when we center our lives around our own desires. And that is so the normal way, so to speak. Human beings are slugs, and that's what we do without some method of being like drummed into. That's why we have training. And training is something that demands that you think of something larger than yourself, and demands that day after day for quite a while, because that's what it takes, day after day for quite a while. And then you're trained, and then you leave, and then your life is very alive. So there's a good ending to this sad story. All right. Thank you.
So the next one that we have is, could you go over the sequence involved in all beings coming to us and allowing us to practice?
So this sequence, I relate to really strongly because it's what happened for me. And the first thing in this sequence is, who am I? And that may take you a long time or not. You may, some people know right away, who am I? And then think of the sequence as cyclical. It's like you get this ball rolling and then it just rolls. So the getting the ball rolling is answering the question, who am I? And you may only have an inkling, like myself. I only had this inkling when I was 13, I really decided I was going to be a writer, and then lots of things got in the way. So then some form of training, the training has to be there. It just has to be there. And then the universe kicks in. The universe kicks in to support and help you and refine this whole process, create a strong direction, create focus, and then co-create what happens from there, so that there's another element besides small you. There's another element that happens, and something in that mixture ends up being just like, somebody stumbling into a zendo and then just kind of, I feel this is good, but I guess I'll do a sesshin. I'll go do a practice period or whatever. I mean, just things just take over. And all of a sudden, you know, they're dedicating their life to the every single day practice of Buddhism. And then they're teaching others. And then they're having Dharma airs. So then that's the universe taking over. And that's also the fourth step of the universe keeps taking over. And things happen and reemerge. And you, in the meantime, you're getting more and more and more authentic of knowing the form of authentic you becomes increasingly specific and accurate and real and alive. That's all.
So the next one is, I'm aware that most of the limbs on the eightfold path have remained essentially as they were in the Buddha's lifetime. Right livelihood, however, have changed dramatically. From his agrarian-based society, he could not have foreseen the work of modern-day people, or the way in which that work is increasingly at odds with our fundamental precepts of causing no harm. Can you comment on this?
You know, our precepts, and by the way, those of you who don't know what the precepts are can go back and listen to, I think it was the fourth series that was all on the precepts. And that's an extremely useful series to introduce you to the precepts in case you don't already know them. But it's not the particular work itself that's the issue, because our precepts can be brought to bear on farming as well as coding. Lewis Richmond, who was a friend of mine at Zen Center, he wrote about right livelihood and talked about it as conscious livelihood. So right livelihood is conscious livelihood. In other words, regardless of our job, our lack of a job, we should be aware of the implications and consequences of what we do. And in some situations, that could be the best we can do. But we're talking about conscious practice, conscious livelihood. And that can be applied to literally any practice. Any practice at all. Thank you. By the way, it is true that of all of the limbs on the Eightfold Path, they're all pretty much the same as when Buddha, just to remind you, this was Buddha's main teaching in his lifetime, was the Eightfold Path. And he taught it on his deathbed. and so this, only this one, right livelihood, is pretty much different. It's very different from how things were in Shakyamuni Buddha's time. So that's correct. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So another one that we just got is the who am I question the same as the Ramana Maharishi question? Is the answer to the question that there is no I? I get confused with all the different references to I with varied meanings. Another example is Katagari Roshi's use of I in his Zen Center poem.
Yes. The answer is yes, basically. To the whole question, the answer is yes. This business of I, which Buddhism, I mean, this is probably the most fundamental understanding of Buddhism, is that there is no inherent individual self, that all there is interconnection. There's just this big, massive interconnection, and we lack an inherent individual self. So this no I thing is Buddhism itself, but it's also other religions. You've heard of Atman and Anatman, and that's self and no self, and there's no self. There is no self. And I think the other one that you gave, Ramana Maharshi, the thing is this isn't an opinion. This isn't like Buddhism thinks there is no self. It's not like that. That's the reality. That's our actual reality. Buddhism isn't like a set of beliefs. In fact, if you attended the Suzuki Roshi series, I gave three series on Suzuki Roshi. One of his main teachings was doubt everything, doubt everything. Not always so. Nothing is always so. So I guess you could say, well, is the fact that there is no self always so? I wonder what he would say about that. Well, there's an exception to all rules. I don't know what he would say. I'm just guessing. Anyway, I guess the short, I know we're almost out of time, and the short answer to your question is yes. I think all religions will express this one way or another, this idea of that we lack an inherent individual self. It may sometimes be in the esoteric part of the teachings of whatever religion. I mean, Buddhism is right out front with it, first center stage. But some other religions may not feature that. But if you read their texts or the liturgies or their, the kind of scriptures, you'll find it. Since that is reality itself, and most religions are about reality, or they get to it eventually. All right, well, I see we're out of time, we're over time, and I want to absolutely thank Sahar and Brian, who are here, and Brendan, for all of the work they do to make these talks possible. I hope to see you next week.